Well, when we left Saul, and when we left, well, Saul and Barnabas, also known as Paul, they were in the city of on the island of Cyprus called Paphos. And who were they? Who were they talking to? Does anybody remember the guy? The proconsular, Sergius Paulus. And again, it's fascinating how our English translations will say Sergius Paulus, and then when we come to Saul's other name of Paul, it's the same Greek word, but they call the one guy Paulus and the other guy Paul. So not sure who made that. I think that's just tradition that we do that, but that's fascinating to me that that happened. So anyway, so they're down here in Paphos. And the Sergius Paulus responds to the gospel of Jesus Christ, and he responds and he sees the power of God because what happens in Sergius Paulus's presence? What happens to the guy? He was blinded. And what was the guy's name? He went by two names. Bar-Jesus. Or Bar-Jesus being son of Joshua. And of course, the play on words there is as Saul, who's also known as Paul, stands up and he says, "You are not son of Joshua. In fact, you are the son of whom? Of Satan, the devil." And so he gets blind, and Sergius Paulus, a high-ranking official in the Roman government, becomes a follower of Jesus. And so in verse 13, we pick up that kind of their travel. So they leave here at Paphos and they head north. And they go north into this city there of Pergam. Why do they go to Pergam? Because that's the port city in this area when they go up to north here. So that's, again, it's one of the things when we read this, sometimes we don't understand why does Paul go to certain cities. Some of it is because of the port cities. Some of it is because, as we'll see tonight, it's a major city in that area. So, but they go up to this city of Perga there in Pamphylia. Fascinating thing is this. This is not the first time we hear of the area of Pamphylia. We actually read about it in Acts chapter 2. So I'm going to read Acts chapter 2, verse 10. The context of Acts chapter 2, does anybody know that the context of that? Remember the context of Acts chapter 2? Pentecost. So this is that scene where God pours out His Spirit 50 days after His resurrection, Jesus' resurrection. And so you have this time of Pentecost, and there are Jewish people from the entire Roman Empire, that's what verse 5 says, and then they're listed. And so if someone could read Acts chapter 2, verse 10 here. And so here we have Jewish people from all these areas, and there's other areas. You can go all the way back to verse 8 where they start listing these. Jewish people from all over the Roman Empire are there in Jerusalem, and they hear the apostles, the disciples, speaking in their native tongue the things of the Lord. And some of them were from this area, which makes sense, because when we get to the scene tonight, we realize that there's a huge Jewish population throughout this whole area, which is where Paul and his companions. It's fascinating in this. Verse 13. So up to now, the first 12 verses of chapter 13, you talk about Barnabas and you talk about Saul. Then you get down to the scene and where Saul starts talking, and down in verse 9 of chapter 13 it says, "But Saul, also called Paul, filled with the Holy Spirit, begins speaking." Then you get to verse 13, and who's the only one that's mentioned? Paul. And it says, now Paul and his companions. So we're assuming that Barnabas is with him. Because that would be with his companions. And there has to be other people traveling with them. But we do know, according to verse 13, who is not traveling with them? John. And this is not the Apostle John. This is, what's his other name? John Mark. The guy who writes the Gospel of Mark, who travels with Peter, who also becomes a companion of Paul's again. But there is this disagreement. And it is, the wording is fascinating. I don't have this up there, but just verse 13, it says, again, the translation that I was reading, it says, and John left them. It's a little more harsher than that. Does anybody have another translation there? And John, does everybody just say, and left them?
Separated.
Departed. It's even stronger than departed is deserted. If you're in the military and you desert something, you can get arrested for that. That's the language here, is John Mark just deserted them. He got up one day and was like, hey, I'm out of here, and went, returned back to Jerusalem. And of course, Jerusalem is where John is from. So that is... he's just going back to his hometown. So, but verse 14. So they arrive there in the port city of Perga in Pamphylia. Verse 14. They go up to this city that is called Antioch in Pisidia. Now, Pisidia is kind of the area. This is the other Antioch. This is one reason why you have Antioch in Syria, which is the one that it sends them. And then this is Antioch in Pisidia, which is that in that northern area of Galatia. Have you ever heard of the word Galatia before? Hopefully, yes. That's where the Galatians, the letter, the book of the Bible called Galatians. But that's this area of Galatia. So when Paul writes that letter to the believers in Galatia, he's writing to the believers living in this area, and one of them in the town is that Antioch Pisidia. He spends the rest of his first missionary journey all throughout this area of Galatia, that yellow area. So, but he is there. And the reason why he goes to Antioch there in Pisidia is because that's the main city in this area. It is not as large as the other Antioch, but it is a major city in this area that is both militarily, the military, the Roman soldiers had a kind of a fort in this area, but also just governmentally, this was that area. And so as they go from Perga to Antioch, I always find this fascinating, is the distance that they would have gone. It's around about 130 to 150 mile journey between those two cities, which is somewhere between 4 to 5 days of very strenuous walking, because if you can kind of see through this map, it's pretty hilly, it's pretty mountainous. And so this isn't like jumping in your vehicle and going, but this is Paul and his companions going on a 5-day journey to get to the next city. And of course, they're not just walking and hiking. I mean, they're sharing the gospel along the way as well. So that is something to keep in mind as well. But what do they do? So when they get to Antioch there in Pisidia, what do they do on the Sabbath day? They go to the synagogue. Why do they go to the synagogue? That's where the Jewish people gather. What ethnicity is Paul? Jew. So this is he, the believers in Jesus Christ, and this is something to think about. That the believers in Jesus Christ, just because they started believing in Jesus Christ, didn't mean like they stopped going to the temple. You still see even the early chapters, they would go to the temple. They would proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ in the temple, but they still went to the temple. They were seen as part of, they would go to the synagogues, and they would still gather with Jewish believers, and they would tell the Jewish believers that Jesus is the Messiah, but they still were gathering, and everywhere Paul went, he talks about this, I think it's in Romans, is where he talks about how he goes to the Jew first, and then he goes to the Gentile. Why would Paul go to the Jewish people first? Why would Paul and Barnabas and the other apostles want to go to the Jewish people first? Who should have known that Jesus was the promised Messiah? The Jewish. That's what we're going to find out tonight. There's this common language that Paul can explain. This is who Jesus is. That he can't go to a pagan person. And it's totally different than when he goes to the Mount Mars mountain where he explains, you know, the gospel of Jesus. And he has to start with the tomb of this unknown God. And then he explains, you know, you're really religious and you have this tomb of the unknown God. Let me explain to you who this God is. And he has to start in a totally different place. Where here, there's already this commonality where he kind of just reminds them of their history and kind of can say, oh yeah, by the way, when waiting for the Messiah to come, guess what? The Messiah has come. And so that's one reason why they go to the Jews is because they should have known. They should have been understanding that Jesus was that promised Messiah and should have accepted the gospel a lot sooner. But as we'll see, that is not what happened. So they go to the synagogue. And we get to see a little bit of what happens. So in verse 14, on the Sabbath day, they go into the synagogue, they sit down. Verse 15, what happens in the synagogue? They read the law, they read the prophets. What else happens while they're there? They were invited to speak by whom? The synagogue rulers or the leaders of the synagogue. And so we get to see a little bit of the order of service within the synagogue life. And it's fascinating. This is actually what the Jewish historians kind of have laid out, that when a Jewish people would gather at synagogues, when did the practice of going to the synagogue begin? Does anybody know? During the exile. While the Jewish people were, the temple was destroyed, and the majority of the Jewish people were scattered all throughout the nations, and a lot of them were over in Babylon. They began gathering again. That's what that word synagogue means. Actually, technically, the word synagogue means gathering place. The gathering place of Jews is what the Jewish synagogue actually means. They would gather together, and then this is what their service looked like. They started with what's called the Shema. And that is something that the Jewish men every single day would quote. It actually comes from Deuteronomy chapter 6, where it says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God." And technically it is, "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God is one. You should love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, might and with all with your mind, with all your strength. And of course, that we should know those that from when Jesus says, you know, what's the greatest commandment? He quotes from the Shema. Here in the word Shema, why it's called Shema, is the Hebrew word for hear. So that's why it's called the Shema. So then after they say that, and again, all the Jewish people would quote it together, kind of as that, what we would say, you know, call of worship or the call of gathering, there would be some type of prayer. And probably was more of a read prayer, maybe even reading of the Psalms during that time. But then they would have the reading of the law and the prophets. Why would they read the law? Because they were supposed to live by it. And they were gathering together to remind themselves, this is how God wants us to live. And then they read the prophets. And again, that's the book of Isaiah, Jeremiah, the minor prophets, even some books that we may not really consider as prophets, like 1 and 2 Samuel. They consider that part of the prophets in the Hebrew Bible. And then there would be some type of message that was given. And it wasn't so much by the leaders or the rulers of the synagogue, but somebody, like if there was a visiting Pharisee or teacher of the law, they would invite them to stand and give some type of message. And that's what is happening here as they go through this order of service. And we don't know, maybe someone tips them off that Paul was trained to be a Pharisee. We don't know. But somehow, some way, they turn to them, verse 15, after reading from the law and the prophets, the leaders of the synagogue sent a message to them, saying, brothers, if you have a word or if you have a message of encouragement for the people, then stand up and say it. So here's what the leader of the synagogue, this is what their job was. They were to take care of the building. So, and part of that taking care of the building was they were to maintain the scrolls and maintain that, make sure that the scrolls were taken care of. They were the ones that were going to the back room and taking out the scroll of Isaiah and handing it to the person who was reading, or the scroll of Genesis or Exodus and handing it to the reader. So that was part of their job, was to maintain the caring for the building, the kind of the maintenance worker, the trustee of the building, but also maintaining the care for the scrolls. They were the ones that were making the arrangements for the public service. So they were the ones that were deciding, hey, today we're going to read from this section, or today we're going to read from this section. So you think of when Jesus shows up at the synagogue, the leader of the synagogue comes and brings him the scroll of Isaiah, and he doesn't stand there and this leader doesn't say, hey, can you read for us from Isaiah passage? Then Jesus opens it and reads it where he reads that section about the how he's been anointed to preach and so forth. So, but that was the synagogue's leader's job, was to say, hey, today we're going to read from this book, today we're going to read from that book, and so forth. He was also to appoint members of the congregation to read the scriptures. So not only was he organizing it, but he also would be like, hey, so-and-so, can you read for us this today from this section? And then he was the one that also would invite people to speak. So he was kind of the one that was in charge of doing all that. He was not the one to speak, though, which is fascinating when you think about that. When believers started gathering together in public services, they copied the synagogue model, which is makes sense. Because initially, the majority of the believers were from what ethnic group? They were Jewish. And this is what they knew. So they gathered together to encourage each other, to remind themselves of the gospel of Jesus Christ, to read the gospels and to read from Paul's letters, to read from Peter's letters, and then they would have the leader who was called at that point in time the pastor or the shepherd. Pastor is a Latin phrase, is the Latin term for shepherd. That's where we get the word pastor from. To shepherd people, to help them grow in their relationship with Jesus Christ. And so that's where you get that model from. So here's a random question. Who is the most famous synagogue leader in the New Testament? There's only one synagogue leader that we know his name. And that's the most famous, that's what I call the most famous one. If someone look up Luke chapter 8, verse 40. Luke chapter 8, verse 40. And once you hear the name, you'll recognize this story. Luke chapter 8, verse 40. Whoever has that, go ahead and read that. You have to read verse 41, sorry. 40 and 41. And so, Jairus. And remember this scene, what happens there? Does Jesus go with him? Well, Jesus does go with him. They hear that the daughter dies. And as Jesus shows up at Jairus' house, he tells them, "Why are you mourning?" And they all laugh at him. He takes Jairus and his wife and I think Peter, James, and John, if I remember right, with him into the bedroom, and he raises Jairus' daughter from the dead. Then when you get down to verse 51, and when he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him except for Peter and John and James and the father and mother of the child. And of course, the father of the child is Jairus. And all were weeping and mourning for her. But he said, "Do not weep, for she is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him, knowing that, no, she really was dead. Verse 54, but taking her by the hand, he called, saying, "Child, arise." Her spirit returned, and she got up at once, and he directed that something should be given to her to eat, and her parents were amazed, but he charged them to tell no one what had happened. And I have no idea how you can keep that one a secret. So, but Jairus is the reason why I say he's the most famous one, because we are only told that one leader or ruler of the synagogue, and that's him. So just a random Bible trivia if you ever play Bible trivia games. So there you go. So they get up. So they are invited. And so when I read through this message that Paul gives, you know, what message of encouragement does Paul give? If you had to sum it up, what does Paul's message entail? What does he talk about? The things that happened to the Jews. And at the end, he switches to talk about whom? About Jesus, about God. And how, and really what happens throughout this whole entire, this is probably a summary of what Paul says in the synagogue. This is not his whole, I want to say, sermon. But it really is, as Paul goes throughout the entire Old Testament, he summarizes the entire Old Testament, and he explains to the Jewish people that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. And then at the end, he talks about how there's forgiveness of sins in Jesus's that's proclaimed to you through this man, that we can't receive by the law of Moses. And so it's really as Paul, the message of encouragement is he explains the gospel of Jesus. from the beginning of to from Abraham all the way till where Jesus is resurrected. There are, it's fascinating when you start looking at what Paul says here. There's, he talks about two groups of people being in the synagogue there in verse 16. What two groups? So Paul stands up, motioning with his hand, and he begins to speak kind of second half of verse 16. What two groups of people does he mention in this second part of verse 16? The Jews and the Gentiles are the two groups. The Jewish people, Paul calls what? What's the first one? Men of Israel. So that would be the Jewish crowd. Men of Israel. Typically, and this was just the culture of the day, especially the Jewish culture, typically men would go to the synagogue. There would be some women in some places as well, but they would sit separately from the men. But so he's announcing, he's saying, men of Israel. In other words, Jewish people. And then he says, and what's the second group? The Gentiles, but these are specific Gentiles. Those who fear God, or the God-fearers. And these are Gentiles, non-Jewish people, who recognize that Yahweh, the Lord, is the one true God, and they would go to the synagogues to hear God's law, to hear the prophets, and they would be a part of the Jewish gathering. But they were not Jews. They were not full Jews in the sense that they had not been circumcised, or they had not been maybe following the entire law, but they feared God and desired to walk in obedience to Him. So that's these two groups. So within the synagogue gathering, you have a mixed crowd. Jewish people and Gentile people who believe that Yahweh is the one true God. So the Jewish people from Jerusalem may have considered these people liberal Jews because of that. I don't know. But it is fascinating when you think about some of our mentality of how isolated the Jewish people were, especially outside of Jerusalem, outside of the nation of Israel. Things kind of were a lot more interactive with the Gentiles than maybe the people there in Jerusalem. You think of the ones, Rahab and Ruth are like two of the examples everybody points to because of being in the genealogy of Jesus. Rahab was a Gentile, but because of what happened, of course, to her town and Jericho being destroyed, and her faith and trust in God, she becomes part of living with the nation of Israel. See, she intermarries with the Jewish people, which is why she's in the genealogy. Ruth is the same way. Ruth is from Moab, and as Naomi is her mother-in-law, comes back to Israel after the famine, and she becomes a part of the Jewish nation, and that was the plan. That was when you look and you read through the Old Testament law, especially when you get into Deuteronomy, the plan was never to have an isolated people group. The plan was for the Jewish people to live in such a way to announce to the nations that Yahweh or is the one true living God, and that the nations would be attracted to the serving and worshiping God there at the temple in Jerusalem. That was the purpose of the nation of Israel. They were to be that mouthpiece to the nations. So, but yeah, that's so God wanted. You get to the minor prophets. I was reading through. I was reading through the book of Amos a few weeks ago, and you see again. You so many times were told, oh, God just cares about the Jewish people in the Old Testament. When you read through the minor prophets, he's talking about all the nations. He's talking about how, now he's talking about in some of them is I'm going to destroy this nation because of their sin. And then he comes back to, oh yeah, by the way, nation of Israel, you think that you're going to get away with it. No, you're not going to get away with your sin either, because I'm going to come and judge you as well. But God is, he's over all the nations, and he desired all the nations to come and worship him. And in the Old Testament, that was part of that was as the Jewish people lived in obedience to God, God was going to bless them. And then they were going to live in such a way that attracted all the other nations to come and understand that the Lord is the one true living God, which is exactly what happened to Rahab, right? 40 years ago, we heard how God brought you out of Egypt, and our hearts melted. And when you entered into this land, we know, or more, I know that God is giving you this land. And that's, and again, you saw her faith in that. So there's two groups here. And so as Paul goes on, he says, no, the God of the people, Israel, the God of this people, Israel, chose our fathers, made the people great during their stay or their sojourn. In what land? In Egypt. And so he goes back and begins to explain how God is working there in the nation of Israel. How they went down to Egypt. And then how, and with an uplifted arm, and this is literally it's an extended arm. And what it was referring to is, especially in first century, going back in the Old Testament, you would, this is a kind of a computer enhanced drawing of Pharaoh in one of the tombs. And you would always see whenever there was this some military victory, they would always paint Pharaoh standing with his right arm, not his left arm, his right arm, which is interesting. That would be his left arm. Yes. Usually it's his right arm. Maybe, looking at me. But it's outstretched, lifted high. So I just realized as looking at that, I was like, wait, that's, Anyways, so usually his right arm stretched out and lifted high. And that's what Paul is talking about. With a mighty arm, with an outstretched, extended arm, the Lord conquered the Egyptians, and he led them out of Egypt. And then he goes on and says in verse 18, and for about 40 years he put up with them where? In the wilderness. It's fascinating how Paul puts that, right? For 40 years, God does what? Puts up with them. So it's, again, you think about the wilderness wandering and why they wander, and literally they walk and make one entire circle to there for 40 years. When it was only supposed to take them a few days to get to the promised land, it took them 40 years.
And they never figured that out.
Well, they did. They knew that it wasn't supposed to take 40 years, but God told them, he told them that this generation is going to die. Because of your rebellion, because of your lack of faith, this generation is, and it's the military generation, that's I think it was 20 years and older, I believe, if I remember right. You can go back into like Numbers and in Exodus, and where you can, especially Numbers tells you that. That's why it's called Numbers. It starts with the census, it ends with the census. It proves that entire generation of military age fighting people died in those 40 years. So, except for two. Who were the two that lived? Joshua and Caleb. And why were they the only two that were allowed to live? Because they gave a favorable report. Yep. So they were the only two. Even Moses died without entering the promised land. So for 40 years, they wandered in the promised land, verse 19. And after destroying how many nations? Seven. Now, where in the world does Paul get that from? From the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 1. The seven nations are listed. And you can turn there. We're not going to read there because I have them listed here. But you can go back to Deuteronomy chapter 7 where Moses, and that's what Deuteronomy is Moses preparing this new generation as they are about ready to enter into the promised land. The book of Deuteronomy, the title of Deuteronomy actually means second law. Where Moses is giving the law again to a new generation. And part of Deuteronomy chapter 7 is this understanding that God is going to bring you into the promised land. God is going to give you the land of the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And they are more mightier than you. But he's going to give you their land as an inheritance. And so those are the seven nations that Paul is referring to when he says seven nations in the land of Canaan. He gave them, he continues, he gave them as a land as inheritance. All this took about how many years? 450. Where in the world does Paul come up with 450? Does anybody know? From the time of Abraham to the time the Israelites entered into the promised land was around 450 years. And so that's where... No, sorry. Hold on. Let me double check that. I think it's actually the time Jacob actually, if I remember, the time Jacob actually enters into... And boy, that's what, yeah. So that when Jacob or Israel enters into Egypt, they are there for 400 years because what I'm thinking with Abraham is when God tells Abraham, no, I'm going to give you this land, but it's going to be not you, it's going to be your descendants. They're going to go down to live in a foreign land for 400 years, and then I'm going to bring them up. And so that is what God tells to Abraham. Jacob then goes, and they're in Egypt for 400 years. So, and actually, it's in Exodus 12, verse 40. The time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. So that's why it says about 450. Don't kill Paul because he's about 30 years off, but that's okay. So seven nations, 450 years, and then after that, of course, the judges until Samuel. So. Yep. Yep. Yeah, well, that's what happens exactly. We want to be like the other nation, which is exactly what it's fascinating when you read through the book of Deuteronomy. And when you read through the book of Joshua. I mean, both Moses and Joshua tell them there's going to come a day when you are going to reject the Lord and desire to be like the other nations. And they're always like, no, 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 that day's never going to come. And then they would sell it again. There's going to come a day when you reject the Lord and you're going to, and you desire to be like other nations. And that's what the book of Judges is all about, is how at the end they Samuel becomes judges. There's no king, and everybody does their own thing. Samuel comes to power as prophet. And then they're like, at the end of Samuel's life, we want a king. And Samuel's like, are you serious? And then you have that conversation between God and Samuel where God says, listen, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me because I'm supposed to be their king. And they're saying, we want an earthly king and like all the other nations.